This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. For years, psychiatric hospitals have been working to reduce the use of restraint and seclusion of patients, looking to find new ways to calm those who are agitated, who might pose a threat to themselves or others. These practices aren't limited to institutional or medical settings. A national report from ProPublica and NPR shows that restraint and seclusion was used in public schools at least 267,000 times in the last school year alone. And many of those instances result in injury to the student and even occasionally in death.
It is used when a child is, for example, in the process of clawing their eyes out or tearing their hair out or smashing their head up against the wall, and they need to be restrained so that they can be stopped from hurting themselves.
That's Dan Dominich. He's executive director of the American Association of School Administrators, talking to NPR for a story in June. Critics of the practices, like Catherine Lehman of the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, say that they're used far too liberally with too little regard for the student's well-being.
Where we remove a kid from a classroom, where we seclude the child, or where we restrain the child, the message that we send is that the child has so little value that we won't even try to educate that student, and instead we'll just restrain the student.
Today on Where We Live, restraint and seclusion in the public schools. We'll talk to an administrator on the front lines of this issue, and we'll bring in Connecticut's child advocate to see how our state is doing in trying to limit these practices. And we want to hear from you. Do you have a story of restraint or seclusion in the public schools? Where do you think the lines should be drawn in their use? You can join us at 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter, at Where We Live. Joining us first is Heather Vogel, who's a reporter for ProPublica, who worked on this story with NPR. You heard those voices before from a story by Joe Shapiro at NPR, and we'll put up links on our website, WNPR.org, to that story. Also to this report by Heather Vogel. And welcome to the program, Heather. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, John.
So, first of all, explain why you decided to go down this path. What led you to look into the statistics around restraint and seclusion?
Well, you know, I had written about this issue 10 years ago in South Carolina, but it was issue of restraint being used in group homes. There had been a child's death there, and sort of a lot of discussion in both Carolinas about what was appropriate in these institutional settings. And then this spring, I got a call from an advocate, a parent who was advocating for other parents of children with disabilities, who had a mom who had been talking with her, whose child, who was a kindergartner, had been repeatedly restrained in public school. And I was, even though I'd been writing about schools for years, I was surprised to hear that this was happening in a public school setting. And that was sort of what got me thinking about it. And then I also saw, a press release from Senator Harkin's office about an investigative report they put out this spring. And so I saw there was some action on it and started looking into it and found out there was new data that told us a little bit more about how prevalent it was.
Your story explains this data, but of course, as most good stories do, it starts with people, both your story and the story that Joe Shapiro tells in NPR, the story of Carson Luke and his family. Can you just quickly tell us this story so that people get an idea of what we're talking about here?
Sure. This is a family that lived at the time. They lived in Virginia at the time. They just moved there from Maryland, and the mother's name is Heather Luke, and her 10-year-old son at the time, his name's Carson, has autism. And he'd been placed in a school that was dedicated just for students who had either autism or an emotional behavioral problem, in a public school. And he apparently was having more outbursts than he had in his last school, where he had been a little bit more integrated into sort of the mainstream setting. He hadn't had too much of a problem, but he was having more behavior problems in this new school and was being brought to a room that they were calling the quiet area. But what it was a cinder block room with a dim light, and it had doors that locked, a big metal door. And this is in a fairly decrepit building. I don't think they even use anymore, with a leaky roof, and it was not a very comfortable setting for, I think, anybody. And he would be shut in this room, and they would tell him to stop yelling, to stop screaming and to calm down, or they would threaten to run this fan that really aggravated him and sort of would set him off. And so he kind of became very frightened of this room. And so one day he had started an outburst, and it had included, I think he was throwing shoes, and he was scratching, I think, and hitting. And they brought him out into the hallway, and from what his mom can, from what he's told his mom, you know, when he was brought into the hallway, he got more upset because he believed he was being going to be brought to the seclusion room, and instead of calming down, you would think maybe removing him from the room would help him calm down a bit, but it had the opposite effect because he'd been put in this room so many times apparently, and sure enough, they decided they were going to bring him back to the quiet area. And it took several staff members to kind of muscle him down the hallway. I think they restrained him and then tried to walk him down the hallway, and he was resisting. And they got to the room and tried to push him in. And we don't know exactly what happened. Either they didn't get him in all the way, or he rushed the door, or something happened. But they tried to slam the door really quick to lock him in, and they ended up crushing his hand in the door. And somehow also his foot, I don't know if it was caught in the door or if this happened during another part of the struggle, but he ended up with a broken hand and a broken foot. And the cut on his hand from the door, it got caught on a bolt, and it pierced his palm. It was sort of a half moon shape in his palm that it was so deep it exposed bone. And so when his mom showed up, they called his mom, and he was sort of, you know, just about in shock, sitting in the nurse's room. She, you know, rushed him to the emergency room, and he needed to go right into immediate surgery just to close the wound. Mm.
If this injury had not happened, would anyone have been alerted to this particular technique that the folks at the school were using to quiet, I suppose, the word Carson?
Well, that was what was frustrating to the mom, was that she had been told he was brought to the quiet area, but she was never sort of made to understand what that was exactly. It sounds, you know, like a timeout, you know, which is something that even folks who are opposed to secluding students are not opposed to. They're not opposed to sort of separating the student from, you know, the action of the classroom, whatever's happening, and giving them a chance to collect themselves. So she didn't understand. She'd walked past this room before, and she said it never, you know, sort of in her wildest dreams did she think children were being find in this room. And her son, and you know, and as is the case in a lot of these cases, these are students who are disabled and often have difficulty communicating. And so her son would tell her, you know, I went to the quiet room, but sort of the quiet area. And so she didn't understand, and it just broke her heart when she realized that this had been happening, and she didn't understand it. But what's interesting is that in a lot of cases, in a lot of the states, there is not a requirement for parental notification, and so parents are not being told necessarily that this is happening.
We're talking with Heather Vogel, who's a reporter for ProPublica, whose story, Violent and Legal, The Shocking Ways School Kids Are Being Pinned Down, Isolated Against Their Will, is the topic of our conversation today. We're talking about this practice around the country. A bit later on, we'll be finding out how it is used in Connecticut. If you have questions or thoughts, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We'd especially love to hear from you if you have some specific experience with some of these issues. Let's turn from the very powerful emotional story that you tell to some of the numbers that you report on. Some 267,000 times used in one school year alone around the country. Of course, not all of the instances are as violent and as problematic as the one you just talked about. Try to paint a picture for us, Heather, about how it tends to be used in school systems where restraints and isolation is used.
Well, you know, there is the data collection around this is very new, and so we're just now starting to get an understanding of what's happening, but we don't really have great data. And when I say that, I don't mean it's a problem that a lot of districts are not even reporting their use at all, but beyond that, we don't have a very comprehensive understanding of the situations that are sort of preceding the use of the restraint or seclusion. or who the kids are, or how many times each kid is being restrained in some cases, that this is all sort of emerging right now because there are new federal requirements on reporting this, the use of these techniques.
And the
Connecticut's a little bit ahead of the game in some ways with their reporting, and I'm sure you guys will talk about that later.
Yeah, and I think we will, and we'll get into a little bit about how Connecticut handles this, how Connecticut reports back on it. You say that the federal guidelines are about reporting, but there are state-by-state laws. There aren't essentially federal guidelines as to how to employ these practices.
No, right, exactly. There are voluntary guidelines that were issued by the Department of Education, but that's all they are, is voluntary. And so you have this sort of patchwork of legislation around the country that in some states you can only use restraints in an emergency. And in some states that emergency can include when there's property damage happening or when there's an educational disruption happening. In other states, they don't define an emergency that way. They say it has to be, you know, harm to a person. And then there are other states that don't have any requirement for an emergency situation. So it's really a piece-by-piece thing. And then you have, of course, school districts layering their own policies on top of it, potentially, and individual schools implementing that.
What can you tell us about training and practices around the country that you've found? We've seen on your website a graphic that shows how some of the restraint techniques are employed, everything from pinning a student down, using a couple of adults to do that, to restraining with belts or some other sort of device. And, of course, seclusion can be a number of things, whether it's in a very quiet room, a quiet classroom, or it could be in a hard, cold cell almost like the one that you described earlier. Maybe you can just talk about how the training and practices differ and what we know about what restraint and seclusion really is.
Well, yeah, and again, that varies too. There are a number of different companies. There's not a standardized approach that I understand. And I believe most of the companies also teach some de-escalation techniques, you know, in addition to teaching the actual physical ways of doing a restraint properly, but I don't even know that there. I don't think there's even an accepted standard protocol necessarily for safe and unsafe restraints, or at least we couldn't easily find one. I'm sure an expert in the matter would have an opinion on that, but it's not like, as far as I know, that the U.S. Department of Education has said do it this way if you're going to do it. And so there's a little bit of debate even on that. I think most of the people I've talked with believe that one of the most dangerous things you can do is a prone restraint, in which a child is lying face down on the ground, because that can interfere with breathing. And so that is, in some states, that particular restraint gets sort of special treatment in the law. There are restrictions on that, but in other places there are not. And in some places there are restrictions for kids who are disabled, but not for the general population. It's really, I would think if I was somebody who was working in this environment trying to make decisions on a day-to-day basis, I would think it was very hard. Because it's hard when you do have time to research it, but if you're in the classroom and you don't have a computer in front of you, that's got to be incredibly challenging.
We're going to be talking with someone who handles this on the school level a little bit later on. We are getting some phone calls, though, at 860-275-7266, including Zach in Willington. Hi, Zach. Go ahead.
Hey there. I just wanted to say that I work in a group home, and we actually are trained in these restraining techniques. And I guess what I wanted to comment on is that we're told that we have we should have ideally three people to do a hold, to perform one, two people for accountability, and a third person to go get help. And this is in a group home setting. We also have what we call a sensory room, which is the kind of seclusion thing. The interesting thing that I just wanted to mention too is that we have a ratio standard for our clients. So when we get into a situation, we have to, we should only have X amount of clients per staff member. And that is less than that, than like a 3-to-1 if there is a situation where we have to perform a restraint.
So you're supposed to have ratios that make sense in case you had to perform a restraint the proper way. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, yeah.
Can I just ask, Zach, what is the age of the young people that you're working with here?
I work with young teenagers.
Okay, so tween age in the 13, 14-year-old range?
Correct, yep.
And are they young people with developmental disabilities, physical disabilities?
No. They are young people who have had traumatic life experiences.
Interesting. Zach, I'll just ask you one last question. I really appreciate your phone call. In your daily practice at the work that you do, how often does a restraint like this or an isolation have to happen?
Well, not often. And I've worked with this company for 2 years, and I haven't ever had to physically restrain anybody. However, the company that I work for is based out of Massachusetts. And Massachusetts has different rules, so when we do the training, we actually had a separate training for Connecticut rules, which are a lot more stringent.
Zach, thank you very much for your phone call. I think it helped us understand this a lot better. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
What we're going to do is take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue with Heather Vogel, who's a ProPublica reporter who's been looking at restraint and isolation in public schools around the country. We're going to get a sense about how these practices are employed here in Connecticut with Sarah Egan. She's the Connecticut Child Advocate, and also Brian Klimkowitz, who's an Assistant Superintendent of Student Services at Plainfield Public Schools. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, and this is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're talking about a report from ProPublica and NPR that was put out back in June. It's called Violent and Legal, The Shocking Ways School Kids Are Being Pinned Down, Isolated Against Their Will. It's about restraint and seclusion in public schools, something a lot of people just don't think very much about or don't know is really going on. Heather Vogel has been doing a lot of reporting on this nationwide. We've been talking to her about this. And I want to bring into the conversation some of your phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266, but also Sarah Egan. She's the Connecticut Child Advocate. She's joined us in the program not only in the past, but fairly recently on other issues. And Sarah Egan, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
For the past 2 years, the Connecticut Board of Education has kept detailed track of incidents of restraint and seclusion in an annual report. There were 378 cases we found, and this was in Heather's report, that resulted in injury to the student. 10 of those injuries were deemed to be serious, but there's a much higher number of times that restraint or seclusion have been used. I guess the first thing I'll ask you is, as you've been listening into our conversation, you've read this report, what stands out to you?
I think what stands out to me is that you know, these incidents are very serious incidents that that children are experiencing, and often very young children. And that the fact remains that I know that these incidents are being used by folks because they feel like they need to use them to control or protect children. But the fact remains that there's been a lot of research done on the use of restraint and seclusion with adults, with children, with people of all types of disabilities. And virtually universally, research and experts tell us that these practices do not help individuals, that they can be very harmful, that they can be very traumatic, and that they are completely unproven and ineffective at reducing the problem behaviors that precipitate their use.
And I think let's go down that road a little bit, because I'd like to talk a little bit more about Connecticut specifically in this and more about what you have seen in those findings. But one who defends these practices might very well say to you, that is undeniably true, that the long-term outcome for the student isn't good if we have to do this. But the short-term necessity, if someone is throwing a massive fit, not just disrupting a classroom, throwing a paper airplane, but physically injuring another student or physically injuring a teacher. What do you do if you are a classroom teacher or a principal of a school and that incident is happening. How do you handle it if not restraint and seclusion?
Right. I think that's a great question. I mean, that is the question that folks have, because I think that our discussion often contemplates restraint and seclusion as inevitabilities, right? A situation has gotten out of control, and now what do we do? And with a lot of problems like that, you know, the answer lies in prevention. And there's a lot of expertise on what works to prevent and reduce problem behavior in schools. And I think, number one, I think, you know, a lot of advocates and professionals would concede that there may always be a time when restraint is unavoidable, when there is an emergency situation and it is needed to prevent imminent harm, even after the best de-escalation and prevention techniques have been used. But barring that, there is an enormous amount of evidence and a growing amount of evidence that there are effective prevention techniques that can be used in either the mental health setting or the education setting that both address school-wide climate and behavior issues, but that also can be used to address kids who are more at risk of problem behaviors that may lead to restraint and seclusion. And I can talk more about that, but we have folks in Connecticut, like Dr. George Sagai from University of Connecticut School of Education, who is a leading expert in this country on something called positive behavioral supports, which is a research-based and evidence-based intervention for improving school climate, reducing problem behaviors that lead to suspension and restraint and seclusion. And there are thousands of schools and school districts around the country who are beginning to use PBIS. Some states are even starting to mandate it.
And so these are techniques that are meant to be inserted before you would get to the point of restraint or seclusion. And we've also reported recently on WNPR and looking at the mental health field that a number of hospitals and psychiatric facilities have modeled on something called comfort rooms, that indeed if you have to move someone to isolation of some sort, there can be a much more pleasant place to put people than the quote-unquote scream rooms that we've heard about, or more horrifyingly, the story that was told earlier about just a black box with hard walls and a flickering light overhead, something that probably any child, let alone one with developmental disabilities or autism, would want to be put in.
Yeah, no, I think that that's right. You know, and one of the things I really want to emphasize is that, you know, if restraint and seclusion are being used as solutions or tools to address a problem, then we have to support our teachers and teachers' aides and administrators in providing them with the tools that they probably want and need to improve their school climates and reduce these types of incidents, which frankly, you know, have to be very difficult, traumatic, and potentially injurious for the teachers and other folks in the school system who have to engage in them. That's not what they want. You know, they want to be able to manage children's behavior. And like anybody else, you know, they need the support and the tools and the training to be able to do that.
We're talking with Sarah Egan, who is Connecticut's child advocate, and also with Heather Vogel, a reporter for ProPublica, about restraint and seclusion in public schools nationwide and here in Connecticut. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We saw these big national numbers from Heather's report, Sarah, 267,000 times restraint and seclusion used, many hundreds or thousands of times that it results in injuries. Those numbers seem right to you?
They actually, my hypothesis would be that they are a gross undercount of how often we actually restrain and seclude children in this country.
And how do you arrive at that hypothesis?
I arrive at that in part because 267,000 restraints and seclusions nationwide. The Connecticut, which I think Heather is right, does a better job of reporting, reported just for last year 33,000. So one could assume that somehow Connecticut has 1/7 of all of the country's incidents of restraint and seclusion, or that states, including Connecticut, are probably underreporting. Because even in Connecticut, we have major cities in our state that report next to nothing. I have at least one major urban city that actually reported nothing to the State Department of Education, reported zero restraints and seclusions. So I think that most folks would agree that, you know, we don't really even know the extent to which these practices are being engaged in.
Heather Vogel, you'd like to pick up on that?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. That is exactly what my reporting was finding out, that in fact the three largest school districts in the entire country, New York City, Chicago, and Los Angeles, all reported zero incidents. Which, even if you had a restrictive policy that said only in emergencies, you're going to have a few emergencies in a district that big.
What can you tell us, Heather, about Connecticut? And you said potentially our state reports a little bit better. Just from what Sarah Egan said, it seems as though we're reporting much more thoroughly than many other places around the country must be. How do you think we're doing here?
Well, the thing that I was impressed with Connecticut was that, you know, not only is there the attempt to collect the information, but that my understanding is that it's used to find that there's another step beyond just sort of tallying the number, that it's used to be able to zero in on potential schools or districts that might need a little bit more of that support, a little bit more of the training. That we were just talking about, that it's a very sort of a proactive use of the data. And I think Florida is doing something similar also. And it seems to me that that would be, the best sort of potential use for the data.
I want to get to a phone call here from Nick in New Britain. Hello, Nick.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
I'm both a teacher and I'm also a member of the school board, New Britain, and we actually recently just had to deal with this issue, especially with regard to our high school. And sometimes there's a lot of misconceptions about the conditions in which some seclusions are happening. I don't know any administrator, any teacher that I've ever met personally or professionally that wants to have to use seclusion or restraint. But there are times where you have emergency situations where you have to think about the safety of the other 20 children in your classroom, when you have to think about the safety of the school. And I think part of the reason that maybe it's underreported is there's this sort of punitive stigma because we refuse to acknowledge that there are legitimate, serious situations in which this is necessary. Just like in the general public, we don't like it when the cops have to put people in handcuffs, but occasionally that has to happen. And the people who are put in the handcuffs usually aren't very happy with the police. In school where you have to use restraint, usually the people who are being restrained aren't terribly happy about it, but there are times when it's necessary. What we have to do is find ways to actually identify best practices for using these tools.
I'm wondering, Nick, quickly, if you don't mind, do you feel as though in the school districts that you know best that this is reported correctly? It's underreported, that we don't know enough about when this actually happens?
Well, there's two issues. One is the report that is put out by the State Department of Education actually only deals with special needs students who are identified as special needs. It actually isn't required to report all instances of seclusion to the state. I actually had to contact the state about that recently because when we were reviewing data for New Britain, that was one of the questions I had, and I actually emailed the state for clarification on that. So I don't think all instances are being reported clearly. I know what we just recently adopted in New Britain was clarifying our policy on how we're going to log instances of use of seclusion and instances of use of, we have a sort of, it's a well-lit security suite in our high school that our student resource officers use. And we created a new logging system to actually try to better comply with the state laws regarding seclusion and also have better internal reporting. So I definitely think there's a need to improve some of the reporting mechanisms.
And Nick, thank you very much for your phone call. I'm going to have to let you go just because I want to move on to our next guest, but I really appreciate your insight on this. And Sarah Egan, did you want to jump in quickly on what he was saying?
A couple of things. First of all, I couldn't agree more that, of course, teachers do not want to be engaging in restraint and seclusion, and that there are some emergencies where restraint may be avoidable. And I think, like any time, you know, teachers have children with specialized or different learning needs or emotional needs in their classrooms. They want and they need And they should have the resources required to be able to educate and support those children. I think the caller also makes another very important point about the conditions of seclusion, which are that seclusion looks different in probably every school system. And I've seen seclusion spaces, just in my role as a child advocate, that are not even rooms. They don't have a door, nothing locks. They're really just kind of a carved out space where a child can, it's more akin to kind of a timeout. But the school did count it as quote, seclusion, and I think probably rightfully so. And then we've seen pictures of seclusion rooms that look like closets, that look like jail cells, that look like, that are lined with bricks, that don't have any sensory support, that are not safe to put children in. And it raises the question of, you know, what are the conditions of seclusion? Why do they vary so much from school to school? And who inspects and monitors to make sure that these are safe or to look at how they're used for children? I think another very important point is that a lot of the children who are subject to restraint and seclusion in Connecticut and probably across the country are young children and children on the autism spectrum.
And we actually want to touch on that issue in just a moment, but I want to bring in our next guest. Brian Klimkowitz is Assistant Superintendent for Student Services at Plainfield Public Schools. We had inquired of the State Department of Education about having someone talk to us on this issue, and they referred us to Brian Klimkowitz, so we're very happy that he's able to join us. Thank you, sir, for joining us here on Where We Live. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. You've been listening to a little bit of the conversation. You've heard from some people who are on the front lines of this issue. I guess I'm wondering, from a school administrator's point of view, what's something that we should know about restraint and seclusion and its use in public schools?
Yeah, I want to thank you again for letting me listen to the show and providing my perspective. This is, first of all, a very important issue in our public schools today and across the nation, and I want to thank journalists like Heather and advocates like Sarah for bringing this issue to light. And, you know, one thing that we promote in our public schools and is safety of our students and educating our students in a way, in a manner that is safe. Like many issues in our district that we faced, my advice or my recommendation is for communication and developing trusting relationships with parents and advocates. I think Connecticut, as was mentioned earlier, does an outstanding job of the requirements of reporting when restraint and seclusion are necessary in our schools. And the documentation that we use and train our staff to use is essential to ensure that that issues such as the story that was mentioned earlier do not happen in our public schools. So we, as Sarah mentioned, I had a chance to participate in the prevention of restraint and seclusions in Connecticut schools of panel discussion back in January. And I had a chance to hear from Dr. Janice LaBelle and Dr. George Sagai. And in Plainfield, we do promote and train our staff in prevention techniques to ensure that if restraint and seclusion is needed, that it is absolutely a last resort and absolutely emergency technique. So we do employ the Dr. Sagai's strategies of positive behavior intervention supports. We do have trained related services staff in all of our schools, including social workers, behavior management specialists, school psychologists, and even BCBAs, which are board-certified behavior analysts, because, as was mentioned, the techniques, the emergency techniques that sometimes have to be employed for student safeties are not designed or research-based in decreasing that behavior in the future. What is designed is the techniques of ABA and controlling what happens prior to a student's aggressive or dangerous behavior and our responses afterwards.
I want to get to a few quick phone calls here. Roger is calling from Middletown. Hello, Roger. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
I'd like to preface this by saying I can only speak to autism because that's all I really know. I don't no other behavioral problems. My daughter is 8, autistic, goes to the public school in Middletown. In the past, she's been restrained in ways that were, you know, were necessary, but it was the kind of typical approach. Anyway, this year she changed to a different school because the program she was in kind of closed down. They moved her across town. Her teacher this year was amazing, really worked at finding new methods to curb my daughter's frustration, which really goes to her lack of ability to communicate. What they started doing is giving her a stop sign. If things start escalating, my daughter is able to raise the stop sign up. They immediately take her to another empty classroom, kind of put an iPad in front of her, and let her just decompress. And this has worked amazing. Her behavioral problems have dropped dramatically. This year she mastered, for the first time ever, every goal on her IEP. Hmm. And I think it really, it just goes to the teacher taking peeling the banana from a different end, rather than trying to restrain the behavior, kind of letting my daughter tell them when she's going to get out of control rather than letting it get to that point.
What's so interesting, Roger, thank you for sharing this story. What's so interesting about what you're saying is we've heard about a couple different types of interventions, some interventions that would happen far, far before anything would escalate, and then also how a teacher or an administrator might have to intervene if indeed something escalates. And it sounds to me as though your new school is dealing with your daughter on both sides, both trying to intervene in a very clear way beforehand, and then if it needs to go to the next stage, it has a much different outcome than just throwing her in a room somewhere.
Yeah, it's never like a specific room. It's just an empty classroom. It's not somewhere where she has to feel like she's going to, I think the biggest problem is people presume incompetence because she can't communicate. But she knows what's going on. She knows that she's getting put in a room that isn't, you know, where other kids are being sent. She knows when she's getting frustrated. She just can't tell people. So coming up with creative ways for her to be able to communicate that beforehand, she knows when she's getting upset, and it all goes back to trouble communicating.
Mm. Roger, thank you very much for your phone call, and I'm glad to hear that things are working out better at this new school for your daughter.
Thank you.
I'm going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. We're talking about the use of restraint and seclusion in public schools. We're going to find out a little bit more about what the rules are here in Connecticut, how it's employed. We're talking with Brian Klimkiewicz, who is Assistant Superintendent of Student Services at Plainfield Public Schools. On the line with us is ProPublica reporter Heather Vogel, who got us thinking about this from her big report in ProPublica with NPR. And also Sarah Egan is with us in studio. She's Connecticut's child advocate. You can join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Connecticut is thought of as a blue state, but the latest New York Times CBS poll paints in a different color in the race for governor. On our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, we will discuss the divided state of Connecticut with our team of reporters and analysts. We'll also talk to our analyst, Bill Curry, who just wrote a big piece for Salon that says his Democratic Party has lost its soul. We'll do some soul searching tomorrow on The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. Today on the program, we're talking about restraint and seclusion and its use in public schools. Sarah Egan is the state child advocate. Heather Vogel is a ProPublica reporter who brought this issue to light nationally with a big report along with NPR. And Brian Klimkiewicz is here on the phone. He's Assistant Superintendent of Student Services at Plainfield Public Schools. We're going to go quickly through some phone calls here because a lot of people want to join us with questions. Roger's in Bloomfield. Hi, Roger.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
My role is I'm appointed by the State Department of Education to advocate for kids with special ed needs in DCF care. And many of these, in fact, most of these kids are highly traumatized. So when they're confronted in the classroom, it's either flight or fight. So in my experience, the major, when you have a seclusion or restraint situation, it's usually because there's been a failure to address the antecedents of that behavior. And as the previous caller said, there are ways to do it. But we just don't have the training in the schools to recognize that these kids, if you confront them, and they also have low self-esteem, they're not going to react in a positive manner. They're going to tend to escalate. And when they escalate, that's where the failure occurs, and that's where the restraint and seclusion occurs.
Roger, thank you very much for your phone call. Brian Klimkowitz, I'm wondering if you might address some of what he just said.
Sure. I couldn't agree more with both callers as far as, you know, the situation with students often comes to communication. As educators, we look at behavior as a means for the student to communicate, and even negative behaviors. So every student obviously is an individual with strengths and weaknesses. So trying to identify that antecedent is not always an easy puzzle to solve. But that's why we do take a team approach, meet with parents on a consistent basis, and even call in outside consultants and experts when needed, when we aren't able to identify clearly that antecedent behavior that results in some potentially dangerous situations for our students.
Let's go to Will in Bristol. Hi, Will.
Oh, hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment. When I was 17 years old, back in like 1999, I had gone to the Children's Home of Cromwell, because I had to be forcibly removed from my high school for fighting with another student. And in this school, they actually had like timeout rooms, like concrete walls and doors with locks on them, that they would put students into when they felt they were either misbehaving or out of control. And I had an experience of being placed into one of these rooms, and actually as I was in that room, like, the staff came in, they tackled me with like four or five guys, and it was a really unpleasant experience, and it seemed like kind of unnecessary at the time, although I do recognize that I was a problematic student at the time. When I was removed from the classroom, I wasn't physically aggressive, I wasn't breaking anything, I wasn't hitting anybody, I wasn't threatening anybody. But they felt that I had made an inappropriate comment and locked me in the seclusion room. Now, the real issue is when you start getting used to this type of thing, you start learning how to manipulate it. So I would start to actually walk out of the classroom and just hide out in there, lock myself in there so I didn't have to listen to them. And you really just find ways of becoming like a worse student.
Mm. And, you know, it's some of what we heard earlier. Will, thank you very much for your phone call. I think one thing I just want to ask you, Sarah, again, have we come a long way since 1999 when Will was 17 and this happened? I mean, do you think we've gotten better at this?
You know, I think in some ways Connecticut is very progressive. In some ways, I think there are a lot of folks who care and look at this issue. I think we have a very, very long way to go. I think that in the treatment field, I think it's important to emphasize in the mental health field, the hospital field, the discussion and the prevention are kind of, I mean, light years ahead of where we are in school. And in part, that's because that work has been going on to reduce restraint and seclusion in treatment facilities for over the last 15 years, in part because federal law does not permit it the same way the law permits restraint and seclusion in schools. So I think Connecticut has a lot of innovative methods to reduce restraint and seclusion, and a lot of those are occurring in treatment facilities. But not necessarily in schools.
I'm going to go to John in Moodus. Hi, John.
Yes. I work actually for the school board in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania. And I work with special needs children. And I've been one-on-one on the bus, and I've been one-on-one in the classroom. Main thing is you have to love these children. You have to kind of really be into their world. And when you do restrain them, you're basically giving them a great big grandfather hug. And I've had a child melt in my arm. You just start to cry. It was completely violent. But I've also had children that, you know, they're trying to smash their head into your face. They're trying to bite you because they're for hurting another child. And on a bus, I've had this happen on the bus, but you just have to hold them. Mm. And a lot of times these incidents, if they get resolved quickly, they actually don't get reported. But it really has to do, you have to be calm and you have to be loving. That is really the main thing.
Thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate your experience in this as well. Allison's in Meriden. Hi, Allison.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Yes, I am a teacher, and I find that a lot of the experts never really work in a school setting. You know, and as a teacher, we want to teach to the kids. And a lot of these kids throw chairs, freak out, and they get very violent. And we weren't really meant to deal with violent kids. You know, and a teacher who doesn't even have a pair in their classroom, doesn't have, you know, 20, 30 minutes to talk them down or try to de-escalate in a different way because they're busy taking care of the other students. So sometimes those students that are flipping out need to just be removed quickly. And I feel like there's no recourse for teachers and nothing else that they can really do except to remove these students for their safety and for the other students as well.
Does your school train you very well to deal with these issues, Allison?
Not every teacher is trained, but we have a code CRT team, which they are trained. So you just call over the office and say, you know, the code CRT and trained people come to the room and will remove the student.
Interesting. Thank you very much for that. Quickly, Sarah Egan, something we've talked about is the use of school resource officers in schools and whether or not that results in more students being arrested than perhaps they should. And so here's a conundrum, right? If we have people who really should be called when there's a violent activity happening, that often results, it seems, in students in many school districts being charged with crimes that shouldn't be. Meanwhile, you have Allison in a school, in a classroom, who just wants to teach kids and maybe shouldn't have to be the person to physically restrain or change the situation there. I mean, that seems to me like a little bit of a conflict, a little bit of a conundrum. I don't know how we best deal with that and put the right people in the schools.
Right. Well, I think Allison makes a terrific point, and I think she's exactly right. I really want to support what she said, which is that, you know, she has a job to do and she wants to do it the best that she can. I think that some of the answer goes back to what Superintendent Klimkowitz said. He provided all of the answers in his discussion, which is the use of evidence-based school-wide supports in the form of PBIS, the use of a continuum of resources and credentialed supports from behavioral analysts to school social works, a continuum of supports, an ability to screen and identify students who may be more at risk, and the use of data to analyze where you're struggling in your schools and your classrooms and what resources are going to bring to bear to address those. That's what PBIS is in a nutshell, which is why it is spreading around the country. And we have those experts right here in Connecticut who can help schools like the one Allison is in.
We've been talking a lot about specifics on the ground here in Connecticut. I just want to bring in Heather Vogel from ProPublica here at the end of our conversation. Heather, you've been listening to some of our callers express some of their frustrations around this. Looking at this from a national level, do you see states changing, making some strides since your reporting or just in the last few years maybe?
Yes, I think there has been, you know, more attention to trying to do this in a way that doesn't involve putting your hands on a child or secluding them. I just want to jump in on the PBIS. One thing that was so interesting when I was doing this reporting was learning exactly what PBIS is in a sort of non-jargony way. We were just talking about, you know, there's an outburst in a classroom, and the teacher perhaps is instructed to call in people who will come and, you know, either they're trained and restrained or, they kind of remove the child. Well, talking with another school district in Virginia that had been able to eliminate restraints through a very attentive use of PBIS, one of their tactics would be you don't necessarily call in the enforcers when there's a problem. You call in somebody who has a relationship with that child that's been cultivated ahead of time, someone that the child trusts.
And I have to jump in just because we're almost low on time,
yeah.
but it's one of these intervention techniques that Sarah Egan and you and Brian Klimkowitz were all talking about earlier. What I'd like to do is continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. A lot of people do want to join us. I want to thank Heather Vogel for her reporting. She's from ProPublica. The story is violent and legal, the shocking ways school kids are being pinned down, isolated against their will. I want to thank Sarah Egan, the Connecticut Child Advocate, and Brian Klimkowitz from the Plainfield Public Schools. Again, continue the conversation online at WNPR.org. Our program today was produced by Allison Ehrenreich, also Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.